Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield and tonight I'm delighted to welcome another author to the centre circle. But before we discuss, before we meet tonight's author and discuss their book, let me introduce my regular compadres for these such events. First of all, Mr. Gary Thacker. Gary, how are you, sir?
I'm great, Stu. Thanks, matey. Looking forward to tonight's conversation. Another great opportunity to talk about football and a much underrated and player that's a lot of people don't know a lot about. And the book is a great story about a way to get to know more about this player. So I'm looking forward to tonight, particularly. Yeah.
Yeah, and to be fair, I think you've hit the nail right on the head there, Gary. It's a proper story, isn't it? I think this one.
It absolutely is, buddy, yeah. There's so many things that, you know, we all know the name, and when we get to talking to the our guest tonight, all the listeners will know the name of the guy who was the subject of the book. But I think unless you're very intimately involved with as a supporter of the teams he played for, you might not know as much about him as you're going to find out tonight. And our guest tells a great story about the guy's life.
Yeah, brilliant. And obviously, the second partner in crime, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, how are you, sir?
Oh, we're very well, thanks, Stuart. Very well. How are you doing?
Yeah, good, thank you. How's the title running? How's it feeling now? Five games to go, is it, for your boys?
Yes, five games to go. Finish line in sight. It's just who gets there first now.
Yeah. Do you think they'll do it?
They can and will. It's making the two meet in the middle, you know. So yeah, it's mad that, you know, if we were to win our last five, we'd finish on 97 points, and yet, you know, that might not be enough. You know, that would be absolutely insane.
Crazy, Steve, crazy.
But yeah, we can, you know, can and will. I think we'll do our part. It's just whether Man City fall apart or not.
You're right. It would be devastating to amass 97 points and still not win it. It's,
oh, that'd be crazy. It'd be our biggest points haul. I think our biggest one's 90. We got 90 in 87-88 when we run away with the title that year, and that was our biggest points haul, and that was in a 40 game season, so two games less. I think we're on 82 now, and the last time we won the title, we won it with 79. And someone was saying the other day, I think when Leicester clinched the title, they were on 74 points on the evening that the title went their way. We're on 82, you know, and we're five to go, and we've still not clinched it yet.
If there's any consolation for the neutral, such as myself, it's brilliant, and I am very grateful for what your team are contributing to the title race this season.
Well, that's all you want. You just want a title race, don't you? Because yeah. I usually get to this time of year and find, you know, the Premier League's kind of like done and dusted, like it has been too many times in recent years, that I'm looking. You know, I used to love like Serie A, for instance, and used to be, you know, massively sold on it, and I had a La Liga era and a Bundesliga era, and I was, you know, massively attached to each league various times, sometimes more than one at once. But then I got to a point where kind of like, you know, once you got that realization that title races weren't happening, or one predominant team keeps on winning all the time, you drifted away from it. So now I get to a point around about this time of year and I'm casting my eye across Europe and looking for, you know, the title race. So, you know, this year Bundesliga is looking pretty good for a big finish as well. So, you know, that's what you want, you know, as a football fan. You know, whether you're involved in it or watching it from a distance, you know, from the sidelines, then you just want it to go to the wire, you know.
It's kind of a can, gentlemen, that when we had the preview pod, looking at the Premier League a while ago, a certain person said that City would be favourites to win the league, but if anybody was going to nick it from them and run them close, it would be Liverpool. That person was me, by the way. So massive pats in the back from me there.
I will play that back and just to confirm
I can hear a trumpet being blown outside Gary's window.
Are you sure it's Gary's?
Trombone as well, mate.
And so you should.
Brilliant. Okay, well, we digress. So, tonight, Tonight's subject matter is Thomas Graverson. Loved by the supporters of teams that he served, arguably, as Gary mentioned, underappreciated by the wider breadth of football. The late 90s, part of a resurgent Hamburger SV midfield, before switching to the Premier League, as we're probably more familiar with Everton, and then eventually gaining his shock move to Real Madrid. Part of the Denmark side that made the finals of Euros 2000-2004, also went to the 2002 World Cup in Japan and South Korea. Energetic and eccentric in equal measure. So Thomas Graverson is the subject matter of the latest book. Our guest in the central circle tonight is the author and prolific journalist, Mr. Chris Sweeney, a man whose diverse writing career has taken in topics as eclectic as writing books about BMX biking gurus to interviewing the likes of Mick Fleetwood and P. Diddy. Chris, welcome to the Lob Podcast.
Thanks a lot, guys. Pleasure to be here. Thanks for that nice intro. I'll get the fiver in the post to you for being so generous with my writing. But no, it's a real pleasure to be here, and I'm looking forward to talking to you guys about Thomas and about football.
Brilliant. Can't wait. So I suppose the most obvious question that we can start off with, if that's okay, is why Thomas Graverson, and what was the sort of the inspiration or the decision to write the book about him?
Yeah, I mean, really, it's a book about, as you said, I'm not a sports reporter. I don't write about sports day to day. It's really a book about someone who I felt was a very interesting character. I felt that there was a lot there that wasn't known about. And the more research I did, the more I found out. And I feel in today's football, you know, maybe footballers are pressured, or they feel the need to themselves to portray themselves a certain way or be a certain way, whereas Thomas was not like that. He's probably the anti-footballer, if that's the way of putting it. He's so different from everyone else. And just his story, the way he went about things, really attracted me. And, you know, that he happens to be a footballer, is just kind of cherry on the cake, because it's quite an interesting world to explore. So I kind of jumped right in there and, managed to get the book done.
Brilliant. Before we start going through the book and start going through his career, if I can just come to you first, Stephen. Obviously, you know, a Liverpool fan, you know, I'm not saying your paths will literally have crossed, but certainly you'll probably be more aware of the impact Thomas Graverson had at Everton in particular, certainly more than myself and Gary probably.
Yeah, I think he at Everton he came in at a difficult time. They just lost Nick Barmby, who was the star asset, and not just lost him, but lost him to Liverpool. And it was a huge, huge blow to them. And they'd had this defined era. They'd struggled throughout much of the 1990s. They'd peaked in the 80s. You know, they'd still been a strong concept in the very late 80s and the early 90s. And then they had this dramatic dip that almost took them to relegation in the mid-1990s. And they looked like they'd kind of revived a bit, but only to dip again quite violently. And then when Joe Royal came in, he took on a club that was just bereft of confidence. And he implanted this hard-working ethos, and the team became it became known as the Dogs of War. Barry Horn was, you know, in the midfield, and it was a big departure from kind of like what they'd known before. Everton were always known for the silky midfields. You know, the team that won the title in 1970 was, you know, the midfield was known as the School of Science. It was Alan Ball, it was Howard Kendall and Colin Harvey. And then through the 80s, they had the Paul Bracewell, Peter Reid, Trevor Steeve, and, you know, Kevin Sheedy. There were so many fine midfielders that they had. And then to have this midfield of workmen, of you know, dubious honour almost, but they worked for the cause, and this kind of like instilled this, I don't know, this new edge into Everton that, I don't know, maybe they felt they couldn't quite compete artistically anymore, but they could fight. And Thomas Graverson eventually came along beyond the Joe Royal years, once Walter Smith was in charge, and he became synonymous with that team, and it was just that fight within him. And he suited Everton down to the ground. And he came in at an unusual time for Everton, because they'd lost Barmby, but they brought in Paul Gascoigne to try and add that edge of skill and talent. And there was a raft of midfielders. I think Nicholas Alexanderson was one. And Graverson was a bit of a curveball in a way. Yeah, he was the most successful, undoubtedly, of that cluster of midfielders that Everton signed in the summer of 2000. And he just, over his 5 years there, he just became synonymous for them. You know, he was the player that, that dragged them through some tough and some good times. And yeah, if he almost became like the living embodiment of Everton, almost.
I mean, you know, Gary, I mean, like I say, you know, Stephen obviously, you know, watched it, saw him numerous times across Stanley Park. As a Chelsea fan and as a slightly more distant observer, what are your sort of perceptions of Gravis and the player?
I guess like a lot of fans who don't know much about the Thomas Gravesen story would consider him as very much fitting, as Steve mentioned, the dogs of war situation, a shaved head, a guy who loved a ferocious tackle, a muscular guy, somebody who battled in midfield.
That stir, don't forget that stir, Gary. You know, stir that could it could have stopped the Rhino.
The 50-yard stir, dead right, mate. But, you know, I mean, Chris's book, it really opens up an entirely new vista on the guy. And, you know, when you read it, you just see, you realise the things that you sort of may have misinterpreted in the past. And I wrote a piece a while ago about Thomas Gravesen being a different type of Danish dynamite in opposed to the Laudrup LKR period in the World Cup. But I changed my mind again because Chris has really opened my eyes as to other aspects of Thomas Gravesen that I didn't know about. And his lifestyle off the pitch, but very much his ability on the pitch, was lost and almost disguised by the perception people had of him.
It's I mean, you know, like you say, this perception. I suppose, you know, Chris, obviously you got to interview people close to him. You know, you must have really got right inside the background of Thomas Gravesen and those early days. And you know, like I say, it's almost synonymous, you know, as the boys have said, you know, about the stare and that dogs of war and that ability to drive teams and sort of, you know, take them with him. Was that something that was sort of instilled from him from a very early, is that the way he's always played the game? Is that, you know, is that the way he's always been? Or is it something that he developed as his career progressed?
No, I mean, I think Thomas has been the same way since he was probably his late teens till he is now. You know, I don't think there was a lot of changing, and you know, I don't think he tried to cultivate an image or a persona, or try to, you know, work on a stare or, you know, come across as aggressive. I think everything he did was very spontaneous, very natural. I mean, he did have a bit of a temper when he was younger, when he was at the Vejle, which is his first club back in Denmark, his hometown club that he supported when he made his breakthrough. You know, the coach there, a guy called Ole Fritzen, who's now dead, that was Thomas's mentor, and he taught him a trick of metaphorically thinking of three stones and changing them from his left pocket to his right pocket, you know, in a way to just calm him down, because he was very, very impulsive as a young guy, you know. And you know, he hurt people in training because he just was all out all the time. You know, he wasn't meaning it badly, but he doesn't really have an off switch, if you know what I mean. So, no, I think those things were sort of maybe innate to Thomas, and I think being a leader came natural to him in the sense that, you know, he was always at the forefront, you know, trying to push his teams on or trying to get involved, sometimes to his detriment, you know, because like he was a homing missile for the ball, you know, wherever the ball was, he seemed to come crashing into the picture at some point, you know. But yeah, I think he was like that all the way through, and I've no doubt that's the way he is today.
I mean, you know, obviously his sort of first bit, I mean, he's a player, and I suppose this is something I didn't know if that makes sense. It's not something I've ever really thought of, but you know, obviously he's played, you know, in the Premier League, La Liga, and you know, in the Bundesliga. Now, to play in three out of the top five European leagues, you know, you have to have something that's about you as a player. That doesn't come by accident, does it?
No, no, not at all. And I think a lot of that's overlooked with Thomas. I think people think he was a bit of a, you know, he's a bit of a kind of chancer that he managed to get this move to Real Madrid and, you know, played at top teams. But everyone I spoke to within the football community, coaches, managers, ex-players who know more about the game than me, said he was an extremely good footballer, very, very skillful and very able to turn things on and off. There wasn't a lot of build-up. He could just do things and then, you know, he'd focus on something, do it really well, and then he could be having a laugh two minutes later. He wasn't someone who needed to get into the zone, you know. And he does have a kind of addictive personality, so he was very keen to practice, to train. You know, he gets really into Call of Duty, He's a massive pool player. He likes playing poker, so he gets into things and he really, really enjoys them. And you know, he seems to almost get obsessive about them. And I think football was something that he did get obsessive about, and obviously to his benefit because it honed his skills and his talent. And like you say, he goes to Real Madrid, Hamburg, Everton, and he plays in the first team at these clubs and makes a contribution. And obviously he was the main man for Denmark for a while. And you know, so yeah, I mean, I think his skill level and ability, I think, is definitely underestimated by fans, but I don't think by those in the game.
It's funny. I mean, you know, like I said, you know, reading the book, and you know, Gary's mentioned, you know, we learned so much about him as a player that obviously I had no clue. And I suppose the move from Everton comes sort of just after he's helped Hamburg achieve Champions League qualification. And like you say, for someone who is maybe obsessive, then maybe a move away from that potential opportunity to another, you know, a different league, a different team, it was quite a big gamble, I suppose, if you like, for him. But to leave sort of the relative safety of a place in Hamburg and the Bundesliga and, you know, like I say, Champions League football, to then have to almost start your reputation, you know, start that career or prove yourself all over again in a different league, was a big, bold decision to take.
I mean, I think it was, but I think people have to, and hopefully they'll get from the book, that Thomas's mindset is maybe not what most people's mindset is. So I don't think he'd be thinking about it like that. He'd be thinking the coach in Hamburg, whose name I always butcher, so I won't try and say it with my Scottish accent. The coach never really they never really gelled. You know, he never really had a good relationship, and he needed to feel wanted, loved, comfortable. He liked community. He liked, that's why where he comes from in Denmark, it's a small place. He likes that kind of sense of community and belonging. He's not chasing medals and money and fame. That did come to him, well, the money and fame did, but, he's maybe not looking at it the same way as another footballer would be. He's thinking, right, I'll go to Everton, I'll be happier, and I'll go there. As long as he can play football, that was it. He wasn't really chasing maybe the prestige of what other players would be. And that's not to say he wasn't interested in football and he didn't like it. He loved it. He was obsessive collector of magazines, watched lots of games, knew all these footballers and obscure leagues. It's not that he wasn't into the game. It's, I think, just playing the game was enough for him and feeling happy. That to him was more than, right, I could be in the Champions League and maybe earn 5,000 or whatever, more pounds a week. You know, that's not something that motivated him.
Right. I mean, Gary, I mean, obviously, you know, he was signed by Walter Smith. And if we look at sort of Walter Smith's relationship with Paul Gascoigne, who a self-confessed eccentric, I mean, I suppose, if a manager was going to sign him or if a manager was going to see the potential in someone like Graveson, then Walter Smith was probably going to be that man.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I think Chris hit the nail on the head when he was saying earlier that With a player like Thomas Graveson, you've got to get him, you've got to understand him, you've got to appreciate him, you've got to treasure him, you've got to love him, you've got to know what the guy can do and give him the chance to do that. And at Hamburg, you know, he said it was perhaps a strange move to Everton, but it probably wasn't, in fact, because the guy there, as Chris said a few minutes ago, he didn't really get on with him. And if you're not going to get on with Thomas Graveson, you are not going to get the best out of this guy. And Walter Smith and Archie Knox have been around the block a few times. And, you know, they said they handled characters such as Gascoigne. And they knew how to get the best out of this guy. It's a sort of talent that you have to not put an arm around it, but you have to appreciate what he does and what he's good at and what he likes doing. Because what he likes doing is what he's really good at. And when he moved to Everton, it was a real sort of almost a coming home, because there was guys there who knew him and trusted him and believed in him. And that's how they got the best out of him. And English football really suited a guy like Thomas Graveson, because this guy could look after himself, no problem at all. But he got the ability on the ball as well to change games and influence the outcome of games. And that's what he did for Everton.
Stephen, you know, when you think about some of the characters that were at Goodison Park at that time, you know, Duncan Ferguson, Graveson, Gascoigne, I mean, it must have been either quite the job or no 2 days are the same whenever you're going into the training ground at Everton. You must never know or never have known what to expect from any of them.
Oh, undoubtedly, it will have been one of the most unpredictable dressing rooms in English football, if football in general, I think. And that was the thing, that Graveson was kind of like, you know, as much as a centric figure as he may come across as, he'd have actually been a steady and influence that summer, you know, to bring back, you know, Duncan Ferguson and to sign Paul Gascoigne and everything that comes with Paul Gascoigne, all that unpredictability and not knowing exactly what's going to happen next. But with Graveson, you would have known what you were going to get. You know, you would have known all the rough edges and all the smooth parts, but you would have been under no illusions that what he will give you is A, B and C. You're not going to suddenly get D, E, F, you know, by surprise. You know, Graveson will give you 110%. He would just work relentlessly. You know, that was the thing about him, was that it didn't matter if he was 4-0 down or 4-0 up. He would still put in the same level of commitment. And for Walter Smith, that would have made him the most important signing that summer. Yes, there was the need for a feel-good factor at Everton that summer on the back of losing Nick Barmby. And that was what Ferguson, the return of Ferguson, did. And to appoint Gascoigne as a wild card. I think David Ginola was another one around that time as well. So, you know, there were these players of talent and upbeat players that were designed to give the fans a boost. But then there comes Graveson, and Graveson would have given gravity within that squad.
I mean, obviously, you know, Chris, you spent time, you know, Everton, you know, talking to people at the club, backroom staff, you know, people who played with him. But in terms of that first spell at Everton, what's your perception of the legacy that he sort of left behind at Everton?
Oh, I mean, I think he's a cult hero. I mean, he's just, you know, everyone you speak to at Everton, their sort of face lights up and they've got this, oh, I've got to tell you this Thomas Graveson story, you know, one time I saw him in Liverpool and he, you know, he did this, and I mean, I was doing some press, talking to some radio station stuff down there, and, you know, a few people told me, like, one guy told me that for some reason Thomas Graveson tailgated him all the way through Liverpool, you know, sort of shouting at him and stuff, and I think it was just as a joke, you know, and then another guy told me how a guy that worked at Everton actually told me that he once took Wayne Rooney, he was coming back from getting his lunch, and here's Thomas Graveson hanging out the passenger side of his car with the window down, sitting on the kind of window ledge, and Wayne Rooney's driving the car, and Wayne Rooney was about 14, he said. So, you know, all sorts of, you know. So, I mean, you know, these stories aren't even in the book, so I think that gives you an idea of the warmth he's felt. But I think the best thing about it is that they're laughing with Thomas, not at him. And I think that was something that in later life that changed, maybe at Real Madrid and at Celtic and maybe in other parts of the media. And I think that's nice at Everton. I mean, they appreciate him as a really good footballer. I mean, in the book, at the end, I have a fans chapter where I talk to different fans that have seen Thomas through his life. And, you know, one Everton fan says he's never seen an Everton team rely on one player as much as that team relied on Thomas Graveson towards the end when he leaves before he goes to Real Madrid. So, yeah, I think it's great feeling on and off the park. I think there's that spirit that he gave. It's intangible, and I think that's the beauty of football when a player can give that to a club or a fan base. I think sometimes it's even more than a trophy.
I need to ask you a question, Chris. I'm really sorry. Just as you were chatting there, and it's just when you talk about, you know, the stories that people tell you and, you know, some that you didn't put in, and I'm. When you have a character like Graveson, and obviously, like I say, it's someone I've learned a lot about, obviously, through your book, but I'm just interested, as a side note, we'll come back to his career in a sec, I'm more interested in yours at the moment, but how do you go about sort of deciding what goes in, what doesn't go in? Is there not a moral duty, I suppose, but obviously, you know, you're writing a book about a person, and you need the whole person needs to be represented in the book, but I'm just interested in how you go about either deciding what goes in, what doesn't go in, what angle you want to try and promote, or, you know, it's just a point of personal interest, I'm afraid.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's a good point. I mean, I try not to come to it with any preconceived notions. I mean, I don't know Thomas as a person, but I spoke to a lot of people who did, and I try to piece my... I guess I'm looking back at his life or his career, sorry, his football life, his career, through their eyes and seeing what they saw. And it all starts to make, you know, and at the end I sort of start to make my feeling of him. So at the start of the book, I mean, I say it's dedicated to him, that, you know, I think he's a great role model for kids. you know, because I feel as though he's someone who didn't compromise. In terms of what I would put in, what I wouldn't put in, I mean, most things, there's nothing really I wouldn't put in, to be fair. I mean, I'm pretty gung-ho in that sort of sense of the word, maybe to detriment of my lawyers and publishers, but I'm quite gung-ho. but, you know, I'm also, you know, I'm not going to make up lies, you know. I mean, some of the stuff people maybe told me, you know, maybe it was a little bit out there or stuff they couldn't think, but if it was someone who'd seen something or someone who had known about it or heard about it from a reputable source or it was well out there, then yeah, I would go for it. You know, there was nothing really that I felt I had to sugarcoat. I wasn't trying to portray Thomas as a great guy or a bad guy. I was just trying to portray him how he came across to me, and he came across as a good guy to me, but that wasn't something I went in, you know, trying to do. And in fact, actually, at the start of the book, I tried to get a hold of Thomas, and you know, him and his representatives told me to bugger off. You know, they said I was disrespectful for writing this book. So, if anything, I probably started off slightly on the negative side, or, you know, with my hackles up a wee bit, because, like, well, hold on a minute, I haven't even wrote this book. So, yeah, I mean, but everything I found out and I could get, I could sort of back up. I mean, I come from a newspaper background, so in that way, I'm not just taking what we would call flyers, you know, just, or somebody told me that, I'll just stick it in. I mean, it was all sort of, that there is everything I can sort of back up to some extent, you know. So, yeah, I mean, it's, I don't know if it's warts and all, but no, I wasn't too bored about what went in or what didn't go in. If it was true, and I thought it was true, it went in.
Like Gary and I said at the beginning of, as part of the intro, I mean, it is a true story, a story about a person, about a character, about a protagonist. It's, and I think that's why it fascinated me so much. But we need to get back. So, obviously, after Rangers, Gary, probably, arguably one of the most unexpected transfers in Real Madrid's history, I think it would be safe to say.
Well, just for some, I guess it would. And there was a story that went around at the time that David Moyes, who was then in manager's chair at Everton, said that he thought it was strange that Real Madrid might have bid, and he might have just said it half-heartedly and joking that it wasn't a mistake and they meant to bid for Lee Carsley as well because he had a shaved head and played in midfield. But, you know, Real Madrid had just lost Makalele, and there was no other Makalele. But they didn't want the Makalele, they wanted the first Thomas Gravesen. And to suggest that Real Madrid made a mistake and signed the wrong player from Everton, he's disingenuous to the point of extreme craziness. You know, Real Madrid are not going to make that stupid mistake. And they went for a player that fitted a template they were looking for. And Thomas Gravesen fitted that template. You know, he's not a Galactico like Beckham or Zidane, but he had his own way of playing. And I don't know if Chris would agree with this, but I mean, I think it was an ideal solution to a problem I had at the time.
Oh, yeah, I think you're absolutely spot on, because, I mean, you know, that you're right about the Lee Carsley whole sort of thing, you know, because they were both bald, white, and, you know, Lee Carsley wore 26 and Gravesen wore 16. So the idea was, you know, go get the bald, white guy with number 6 in his back, and, you know, the wrong guy arrived in Spain. And Lee Carsley, since my books came out, Lee Carsley has since went on Twitter to clear up that it was Thomas. But I think Lee was taking it a wee bit too serious. I think, like Gary says, I don't think MD was really taking that, you know, that story a pinch of salt, really, wasn't it? But, no, I mean, I think he goes there, and I think it was David Weir, actually, that really hit the nail on my head, is captain at Everton, who said that Thomas could either, he would just follow the ball, there was no role for him, unless you gave him a role to the letter and said, just do this. And I think that's what happened at Real Madrid. Initially, I think he got instructions, just do this. And he's actually pretty good at it, because you can see when he's in the team, the results are good. He plays in the big Champions League games, he plays in El Clasico. And then there's obviously a change of manager in the second season. He's out the team to begin with, but he gets back in again, playing in the big games. You know, so I think it's around about 40 games he plays over 18 months, which, considering he was also injured for part of it, is a pretty good return. I mean, he was a first-team player, and it's a hell of a midfield. I mean, Figo, Zidane and Beckham. I mean, bloody hell. I mean, you know, it's not exactly... I mean, you know, if you're playing in that midfield, you obviously need to be decent, because, I mean, you know, that's three pretty good players around you. And I think the good thing is he goes to Real Madrid and you see clips of him, and he's telling Zidane where to run, you know, and he's telling people what to do. Like, he went with that confidence. He didn't go thinking, oh, I can't do this. I don't think he went arrogant, but I think he believed in himself, and I think he had the ability to play that, and I think he showed it no matter what people say, and, you know, make fun of him and call him an awful signing and that kind of stuff, you know. I don't think it's fair, and I think Gary's talking a lot of sense.
I think, just sort of jumping in there, Chris, I just want to say that, I mean, I absolutely agree with what you're saying there, in, you know, that midfield they had, but I think Gravesen was an important part of that same jigsaw. And there's a, you know, people say about Gravesen how obsessive he was, but there's the same coin on the other side, his commitment. And he had that commitment to perform the duty, as you said. Once he was detailed with a job to do, he could do it. And he performed successfully in a massive, massively important and strong and dominant Real Madrid team. And it wasn't a passenger there. He was fully worthy of the place he was given. And he contributed massively to the success of Real Madrid at that time.
I mean, you know, Stephen, listen to what Chris has said there. And I suppose, you know, it's a... You know, a move to Real Madrid or a move to Barca or Bayern Munich or, you know, the sort of the, you know, the big powerhouses of football. And, you know, I suppose, you know, Chris has pointed out there, it's almost a self-confidence thing, isn't it? You know, we've seen arguably more talented players than Thomas Gravesen wilt under the pressure of playing for a big club or a big name. And, you know, and a lot of it does come down to that almost inner self-belief that you belong on that pitch. You belong in as one of those 11 names on the team sheet, isn't it?
Oh, it is. You know, it's what's in the mind. You know, if you think you can, you know, do something, then, you know, there's a good chance that you can. You know, you can either talk yourself into something or talk yourself out of it. And with Gravesen, I think the interesting thing with Real Madrid was that he was exactly what they needed. You know, they had the Vicente del Bosque era, and then the Galacticos were swamping and taking over. And the fact that you had a player like Makélélé, you know, siphoned off because he wasn't a Galactico as such, and you must bring in these Galacticos, then Real Madrid eventually found out that actually you need a Makélélé, you need, you know, players like Guti eventually that will come along and do the basics and do them well. You know, and I said, in a way, it made his arrival at Real Madrid was similar to Everton in the fact that he was the player that was centred in that midfield, that everything else, all the, you know, the aesthetically pleasing players, all the skillful ones who would be full wrapped with self-doubt, but immensely talented, that they could revolve around him. And that's what he did for Real Madrid. He did exactly the same thing. So a different scale, but the same theory, the same, you know, the same ethos. You know, in he comes, and he was again the gravity of that side. He brought the team down to its natural level. Not saying he brought them down to his level, but that he was the anchor of a side, and he did that for Everton, and then he went and did that for Real Madrid.
And I mean, I'm just sort of seeing, you know, I mean, how you were saying there about how I'm not changing. I mean, the great story is, I mean, he goes into Real Madrid, and Thomas did this all through his career. He was very strong, naturally quite a strong guy, they said. And he would always do bear hugs. So he'd get in, the manager, coach, young player, get you a bear hug, and he'd get you about six inches off the ground and just leave your feet dangling. And that was what he loved to do. He just loved doing that to people. So he goes to Real Madrid, and of course, he carries on doing it. But he does it with big Ronaldo, you know, the original Ronaldo, the Brazilian guy. And he's obviously, you know, quite a large man as well, quite well-built unit. So he ends up fighting free. End up rolling about in the ground, having a play fight. And of course, it finishes with Ronaldo minus some teeth. So, I mean, you can imagine Real Madrid thinking, God almighty, this guy's something else, you know. But he didn't change who he was, which I think is really refreshing. And, you know, maybe he's a bit naive, and I mean that in a nice way, you know, maybe a bit simple, but I don't think that's a bad thing in today's world. I think maybe sometimes people always try to, you know, put an image over, and Thomas wasn't.
I think it's funny, we're just listening there, Chris, and I think, you know, myself as a football fan, but I think football fans can see that as well, can't they? They can see the genuine article, as in the player, the personality, why they're there, you know, how much they're going to commit to the club, to the cause, to the country. And I think that's what fans saw in Gravesen. I think that's probably what they appreciated more than anything else.
Yeah, I would think so, and I think that's everywhere he went. He was a cult hero. I mean, even at Celtic, where it maybe didn't work out as much, people remember him fondly for, you know, particularly the players, for the way he was, how funny he was. And the young guys at Celtic, the youth team at that point, they idolise him. I mean, they think he was like a kind of god, because he was just such a nice guy, full of fun, full of life, and you didn't know what he was going to do from one minute to the other. I mean, he was that unpredictable.
It's that inherent honesty in the player. That's what it comes down to, is that, you know, you get these players who are transparent, and you can see, you know, you can see the reasoning and why they do something, or they join a certain football club or whatever it is, you know. But you get those players like, and Graveson ticks that box, is that they're just honest players. They're just honest individuals, honest human being, and you know, they are what you see.
It is, like I say, and I think. Every club that he played for, the fans knew. They just knew what they were going to get when he put on the shirt. And there was never, like you said, Chris, before, you know, it never varied. You just knew. You knew what you were buying. You knew what was going to happen for the 90 minutes. And like I say, I do think fans appreciate that. It doesn't matter what league teams play in, you know, the universal language of football, if you like. You know, I think that came across in everything. But I suppose his time at Everton and at Real Madrid as well, I suppose, coincided, you know, with his international career. I know Stephen Scott, his opinions on Denmark and the 84, 86, and we'll come to that in a second. But in terms of him as an international player, Chris, again, I suppose similar to the Everton question about legacy, but how is he perceived in Denmark with regards to his international contribution?
I mean, one word is hero. You know, I mean, they like him. I mean, they think he's... I think because he went out in that pitch and he kind of did it his way again, he had that confidence and that kind of spirit, and, you know, he would get stuck into whoever it was, Zidane, or it was a guy from, you know, some unknown guy from Latvia. You know, it wouldn't matter to Thomas. He was all in there. Let's go. Let's do our best. And, I mean, it's a very successful time for Denmark because, you know, the team comes together. But like you say, they qualify at the World Cup, they get out the group, you know, they're in a group with France, and particular game against Zidane, Thomas bosses Zidane off the pitch. I'm not saying he was a better player than Zidane, but that day he was. And, you know, Denmark go through, and, you know, they did well in the European Championships as well. And it's good because he's got, you know, Stig Tofting. You know, we talked about Lee Carsley earlier, allowing Thomas to roam about the pitch and, you know, hold us up, you know, sort of basically do his dirty work. And that's what Stig Tofting did, you know, for Thomas, you know, with Denmark. He was also, I mean, the coach did have a wee bit of some issues with Thomas because, again, you know, he would do things about out of the wall. I mean, him and Stig Tofting attacked Gronkjaer, as like I say in the book, and they spray water on his face and rolling about in the pitch, and then he takes his trousers. Well, he takes no his trousers. It's his shorts. He lifts his shorts up and exposes his whatever. Don't know what you call it. I guess his penis. You know, and you know, that's dangling over one of his teammates' heads while his team photograph taken. You know, that, I mean, obviously these things, the coach wasn't too impressed with these things in front of the watching media, but it didn't affect him on the field because he wouldn't think that was anything out of the ordinary. That was just how he went about his life. But yeah, absolute hero. And I think there's actually a great clip anyone wants to watch online. You know, recently Switzerland played Denmark and it was 3-0 to Switzerland. Denmark came back, equalised, and, you know, Thomas was there as a pundit, and he's jumping about the side of the pitch, almost doing cartwheels. You know, and he's pumping his fists at the Denmark fans, and they're going crazy looking back at him. And even this is the guy now retired, but he's got that passion. And you know, with the passion, he was also a good footballer. So in Denmark, they've got nothing but respect for him.
Gary, it's three major championships, you know, in a row for Thomas Graveson. And I'm not saying that Denmark is a minor footballing nation, you know, not for one minute, but, you know, in terms of just qualifying for three tournaments on the bounce is a big achievement, isn't it? But then to be selected for all three tournaments, you know, for three successive squads, again, is an indication of the man's talent at, I suppose, the next level that is above club level.
Oh, absolutely, buddy. And, you know, as you said, to qualify for three major tournaments, ain't no bad thing. And I know we spoke in the past in different pods about the Danish Dynamite team and the World Cup that they played in. And I just think Thomas Graveson,
You know, some people might dispute this, and that's fine, because football's all about opinions. But I just think Thomas Gravesen would have fitted magnificently into that team, in the team of Laudrup and Elkjær and Lerbo and Arnesen. To have that sort of incandescent personality and belief to play in a way that would release the ability of others as well, I think, you know, it would have fitted magnificently into that team. And it's almost a shame that he missed the time slip didn't quite work. But, you know, as you say, you know, he still managed to get the team qualified for three major tournaments and played in those finals. But I'd be interested to see what Chris thinks about that. I mean, would you think he would have fit into the Danish Dynamite team, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I think he would fit into any team. I mean, I think he had football intelligence. Maybe he was a bit of a wacky character. But I think if you could... I think if you could sort of, you know, get on his wavelength or him get on your wavelength, I think he could play in any team. And I think he proved that playing at Hamburg. When I know it's going to be back to the start, but I mean, he goes to Hamburg only after 2 years of professional football to play in the Bundesliga. And he's a first choice pick at Hamburg. So I think that shows that he was able to make jumps and play in different places. You know, then to go from Everton to Real Madrid, where he's the main man at Everton, to a supporting cast member at Real Madrid, again, he fits in there. So I think you're spot on there. I think he would have... I don't think there's a team that he wouldn't have fitted into, if that makes sense.
I agree.
Okay, so Stephen, the lover of the Denmark side that, you know, the two guys have been chatting about, do you... Your opinion on Gravesen in that incredibly beautiful Hummel shirt that was worn in 86, do you see it working?
Do you know what? He probably would do. You know, that was the thing about it. He'd have worked... He'd have loved playing under Sepp Piontek, without a shadow of a doubt, because, you know, it was a brilliant meeting in the middle, that Danish Dynamite side, is the Germanic Piontek having to embrace everything that was out there about Danish football, and it was out there. You know, players kind of like skiving out on match nights to go to nightclubs, coming back in through the hotel, straight out the window to go back to the nightclub. You know, actually, you know, signing in from curfews and stuff like that, and then Piontek's tipping up at nightclubs to find football still on the dance floor when he's just seen them back through reception 2 hours earlier. You know, Gravesen would have thrived in that. He'd have absolutely loved it. And the thing was that for that side, for every LKR and every Laudrup, there was a Lerbu. You know, for every Simpson, he had these hard working. You know, you cannot have a team full of, you know, Laudrups and LKRs and Olsons and Simonsons without, you know, a Gravesen-esque type player. You know, and that was what Real Madrid found.
Yeah, I mean, it's good that you mentioned Simonsen there. Sorry, just to cut in briefly, but you were just talking about Simonsen there, and I mean, he's the first European player of the year in 76, and he's actually from the same small town, Vila, where Gravesen started. And, you know, he comes back to finish his career there, and Gravesen sees that. So actually, you know, that generation of players would have inspired a young guy like Thomas, because he'd be thinking, right, you can come from this small place and go out and play in the big stage in the world. So I'm sure that they'll give him confidence to see guys like that in his midst, you know, not just on TV.
Yep. Oh, undoubtedly. And he'd have grown up on all the legends as well. You know, not just to what they were doing on the pitch, but what was going on off the pitch, because, you know, these Danish players of that LKR era were playing their club football across Europe. And the fact that up until the late 1970s, you couldn't play for the national team if you were playing your trade at a club level outside of Danish football. Danish football was, you know, militantly amateur. So you had to be an amateur to play for your national team. It was only, you know, much later in the 70s that they yielded to say, no, actually, we've got all these talented players dotted around Europe, let's bring them back. But then they would come back and represent the country, and it'd be like holiday, you know, and the match would be there, but then they'd go out on the lash, and it would be, you know, and this is what Piontek walked into. You know, he had to bridge that somehow. He had to find, you know, meet his ethos and the way that the Danish were, and meet them in the middle. So, you know, Gravesen would have known all of these great stories about that Danish side, not just what they did on the pitch, but what they were doing off the pitch, and that love and lust for life, which was clear within Gravesen as well.
it's, I mean, you know, obviously, you know, we've sort of covered, you know, probably the more successful era of his career. And I suppose the leaving Madrid, Chris, I mean, you know, leaving Real Madrid is a, you know, I assume, obviously I've never had to do it, so I don't know, but I'm assuming it's quite a big, you know, it's a big wrench. It's a, you know, it's a big thing. But again, you know, you've spoken to the people and from what I've gathered from the book and chatting and so on. But for Graveson, it seems to me that playing the game is more important than anything else. You know, I don't think he could ever have stood to be a bit part player. So I suppose leaving was going to be inevitable.
Yeah, I mean, I think unfortunately for Thomas, I think he was probably born in the wrong era. I think football, you know, I mean, you know, certainly late 90s, early millennium and sort of going forward, a lot more money, a lot more profile on the game. And, you know, when he goes to Real Madrid, he also starts dating a very famous Danish porn star called Kira Eggers. You know, so he's obviously the most famous player in Denmark. There's Danish newspaper people just based in Spain to follow him, whatever he does. He's going out with this porn star. He's playing for Real Madrid. I mean, for someone who's wanting a simple, quiet, kind of community-style life, you know, it's the total opposite. And, you know, for someone like him, even to keep functioning, playing, I think people would say, oh, well, you know, it's no big deal, but it's quite a lot of pressure for him. I mean, I'm not saying he's, you know, downtrodden and he's a poorly paid nurse or anything. Of course, he's a well-paid footballer and he had a good life, but I don't think that had been easy for him. And I think with football changing, you know, perception, image, when you're part of a brand like Real Madrid and, you know, you're going around the world representing them, they want a certain type of character. And Fabio Capello did not see Thomas Graveson to be that kind of character. And of course, the straw that breaks the camel's back is when him and Robinho have a bit of a scuffle at training, which is on YouTube and everyone's seen it, you know. Robinho was going one way and Thomas is going the other, you know. I know who I would have had my money on in that one. you know, at that point, Capello tells him, you're out of here, pal. You know, you're off-ski. And I think it's unfair because, you know, I think he was uncomfortable. He wasn't feeling he could be himself, and I think that's why it was coming out, because he wasn't a violent guy. If you see his other clubs, this wasn't normal behaviour for him. You know, I think it was three times in his entire career, which is, you know, not a lot for someone who's a supposed wild man, you know. But anyway, he moves to Celtic, and I think he likes Celtic. He wants to go there. Like I said before, he's a student of the game. He knows Celtic. He knows Rangers. He knows about the Old Firm. He's been to Old Firm games as a fan with one of his Danish teammates, Peter Lovenkranz. But, I mean, that's, you know, that's just jumping out the sort of the frying pan into the fire, because it doesn't work out at Celtic. It's a total disaster.
It's funny, isn't it, Gary? I mean, like you say, I mean, you know, these are big clubs. We, you know, we've talked about him playing in, you know, three out of the big five leagues, but then, you know, and Chris has got it absolutely right there with regards that, you know, he couldn't have picked a more high profile club. Obviously, other than Rangers, I'm trying not to offend anyone in Scotland, but, you know, you can't really find a more high profile club than Celtic. So to go from, you know, probably the highest profile club arguably in the world in Spain to then go to one in Scotland, it's, you know, he's not one to clearly not want to shirk a challenge and, you know, go for the easy life, is he?
Absolutely not, no. And, you know, as Chris said, you know, it's almost like a shock almost that it didn't work out there, because, you know, Scottish football, you know, they would appreciate Thomas's commitment to playing. But there again, I mean, I was thinking with players like this, maverick players like Graveson, the manager's got to appreciate him. I think it was Strachan that was at Celtic at the time there. Chris, correct me if I'm wrong. Was it Strachan, am I right?
Yeah, it was Strachan, yeah, it was Strachan.
I just don't think Strachan really appreciated the talent that he had to deploy. And if you don't get Thomas Graveson, then you don't get the best of Thomas Graveson. And I just don't think Gordon Strachan did. And it's a terrible shame, because I think he could have been a massive success in a, you know, and I don't want to sort of be condescending to Scottish football, but, you know, a guy who can make it in Real Madrid can make it in Scottish football.
I'm Scottish, and I'll be condescending, for Christ's sakes. I mean, you know, the sort of B team at Real Madrid can make it in Scottish football. I mean, let's be honest here. I mean, it's a massive jump, and, you know, like you say, it's mind-boggling how a guy like him. It's not mind-boggling how it didn't work out, but it's mind-boggling how Strachan and Celtic as a club didn't use someone like that better.
I mean, they expected him to stick to one set position, which all through his career, and I mentioned it in the book, everyone said he's attracted to the ball. He will not stay in one place unless you give him a very, very specific role. He will just chase the ball. And of course, that's what happens. And they get Strachan didn't like that. And yeah. I think also that the character Thomas was, he, I think Strachan, a bit like Capello, I think it was the kind of school teacher approach, you know, you do what I say, everyone shut up, listen to me, blah, blah, blah. And I think with Thomas, that was never the way to get through to him.
Absolutely right. I just wonder how good it would have been for Graveson to play under Walter Smith at Rangers when Rangers were in the peak, when Gascoigne was there and, you know, that sort of time. I just think it would have been so much better because, you know, I know I've said this a couple of times now, so forgive me for being repetitive, but, you know, you've got to understand this guy. You've got to understand what you've got. You've got to know how to, you know, it's all about management come the end of the day, you know. You've got an asset there and you want to exploit the asset, then you've got to be able to make it work for you. And Strachan couldn't. And as you said, Capello couldn't. Walter Smith massively did at Everton. And I just think that, you know, it's a real shame because Thomas Graveson at Celtic should have been exceptional. He should have been exceptional. And I don't think it's the player's fault that he wasn't. I think it's the management that couldn't get the best out of him.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, I think also he's got that kind of swashbuckling style that Celtic sort of pride themselves in playing. And, you know, I mean, he suits that perfectly. And I mean, but I mean, all the players at Everton I spoke to said that, you know, he wasn't allowed to do what he wanted. He was under the same rules as everybody else, but Walter Smith and Archie Knox and then David Moyes, they treated him differently, you know, and or not treated him differently, but understood him. And like you say, he got that initially at Real Madrid, but then laterally with Capello, he didn't. Celtic, he didn't. I mean, a sort of microcosm of the relationship between Gordon Strachan and Thomas Graveson is Aidan McGeady tells the story, who's now at Sunderland at the Irish winger. You know, he talks about how that, you know, Gordon Strachan's doing a team talk and sort of laying out the tactics. And he looks around and here's Thomas Graveson looking through a newspaper with the eyes cut out. You know, I mean, that just shows you, you know, they were totally on different pages, you know, and I think Thomas felt as though he couldn't be himself again, and football was changing, and, you know, I just think there was a lot of things, but he still wanted to play football. I mean, he gets bombed out the Celtic squad, and he asks the youth coach if he can go on a youth team trip to Ireland, and they're playing like taxi drivers and, you know, waiters, you know, it's like you know, just a small sort of pre-season trip, and he actually asked to go in that so he can play football with these kind of young kids. And you're thinking, this guy was playing for Real Madrid 18 months ago, 2 years ago. What the hell's going on here? You know, it's and of course on that trip, of course he's maverick to the last. He demands, he takes the whole squad to watch the new Batman movie, so he gets a nice big cinema, gets them all watching Batman, and then for the rest of the trip he pretends to be the Joker on the field and off it, I'm told. So, you know, that was him. You know, he didn't change, but I think he felt he couldn't be himself. And I think you can see that spark in him start to go. And obviously then he retires, he leaves football at 32, still fit. And you think, it's only 2 years ago you were playing Champions League for Real Madrid. It's a kind of, I felt sorry for him. I felt it really ended in a low.
Absolutely right, I agree. I just want to make just once a sort of similar situation, and people might think it's a different level, but I don't think it's that terribly different, is that Alex Ferguson knew how to get the best out of Eric Cantona. And he did give him a little bit more latitude, but he understood how to get the best out of him. And I think with players who are mavericks like this, who are out of the norm, for whatever reason, you know, you've got an asset, you've got to use it. And it's all about management or lack of management if you can't exploit it properly. I don't think, do you agree with that, Chris?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, I don't understand why Celtic would... I mean, he was the highest paid player in Scotland when he came over to Celtic. So, I mean, they weren't playing buttons for him. I mean, it was a big investment for Celtic. Obviously, it was small potatoes compared to, you know, the wages he was earning in Spain. But it was a big money move for Celtic. And you wonder why he did it. I mean, you know, Mark Wilson tells the story, you know, that they're playing right back. Well, he's playing right back. Thomas is right midfield. They're playing Rangers away. Massive Old Firm game, you know, the big derby, white hot atmosphere, and he's telling Thomas, you know, shut your left down, I need you to block. And he turns around and says, shut up, lad, because that's how he said that. He called everybody lad. He said, shut up, lad. So the game goes on, and Mark Wilson said to me, I just thought I'd tell him again because maybe he was just joking or whatever. So he tells him again, you know, shut your left down, Tommy, shut it down. And he turns around, he runs up to him this time and he says, shut up, lad, do not talk to me for the rest of the game. And he said for the rest of the game, he just ran about, he was all over the place, left, midfield, up front, behind, you know, and that's just how he was. You know, he just wanted to play football. He wanted him just to shut up and let him play football. So, you know, Celtic, I think, as a club, didn't get him. I think the players got on with him, but the management, the coaching staff, no, it was just...
Right team, wrong management. I think the thing about Graveson as well is that, you know, you can strike a chord between all the locations he played in as well. You know, from moving on to Denmark, you know, Hamburg, Liverpool, Glasgow, you know, Madrid, a completely different kettle of fish, but there's a chord that strikes through, you know, Hamburg, Liverpool and Glasgow that I think attracts him, whether that's, you know, a conscious decision or a subconscious decision. You know, the seaborne cities of a certain order almost. And I think he was possibly drawn to them in that respect as well.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. I mean, I didn't make that connection in the book, but I think you're right there. I mean, I think that's the kind of background he'd be comfortable with. He's not chasing the bright lights. He's chasing
it's a certain environment that he's attracted to, a certain type of city or town that speaks to him, and whether he ever realised that, I wouldn't know. But you know, it just strikes me that the three very very similar cities.
Well, again, in true Thomas style, then his next home is Las Vegas, which of course could not be further from anything. So, you know, the man never fails to surprise you.
It's funny. I mean, obviously, you know, we're coming towards the end of our hour, but I suppose, you know, a couple of things first. I mean, Stephen, if I can just come back to you, you know, with regards to and you know, again, Chris will probably know better answers, but I'm interested from your point of view, Chris. I mean, obviously, Everton, sort of that early mid-80s, went through it, you know, incredible success, you know, playing a certain style of football. And it's, you know, you know Everton fans, you know Everton fans of different generations. You know, and I just wonder what, you know, the sort of the fans who were brought up on maybe Howard Kendall's football, you know, what they thought of Thomas Graveson, or whether he sort of cut across all generations, you know, and everybody could see him, you know, for what he was, or whether he was somebody that they couldn't relate to based on what they'd seen during the Kendall era.
Yeah, for me, I mean, similar to kind of like the fact that he would have fitted into the Denmark of Elkjær and Lauda, he would have fitted into the Everton of the 80s. But the difference was that by the time Graveson played for Everton, his commitment brought him to the fore as kind of like the star player or the generator of the side, the man who was dragging them forward. He became the hero. Whereas that type of player back then in the 80s was the dynamo of a side, but they were the players that provided the platform for the skilled players to become the heroes. So I think that's the difference. It's not that he wouldn't have translated, it's just his standing in a way of what it was when he played to what it would have been had he played his football, you know, 10, 15, 20 years before he did. You know, you can look at Everton thrive, but they needed Peter Reid in there. You know, Liverpool thrive, but they needed, a Steve McMahon. All of those sides needed a strong arm, committed, driven midfielder to create that platform for the others to excel. But I would say that at his time at Everton, you know, he was that hero for them, rather than the man who made everyone else a hero. He was the hero, and that was the difference.
I mean, it might sound a bit out there, but I mean, I mentioned in the book that I think one of the best examples I can promise, maybe comparisons, is a bit like Roy Keane. I felt as though he was kind of in the Roy Keane mould, although no one, I don't think, would ever... I think Roy Keane was probably a better footballer all round, but I think Thomas was in that kind of mould of that type of player.
Yeah, there's some. I mean, and you can probably point to the same aspect, that Keane's time at Celtic wasn't, you know, an uproarious one.
No, that was a disaster.
When people thought similar. So, you know, Graveson was in good company and not succeeding at Celtic. You know, he really was. But yeah, you know, I would say that about Graveson. It is how he translated to his era. You know, he became a hero when, you know, 20 years ago he'd been the hero maker rather than the hero himself.
Oh, nicely put. I like that. I suppose, so, you know, Chris, obviously, you know, sort of before we finish, and, you know, people haven't, you know, haven't bought the book yet, hopefully they've listened to this and we'll go out and buy it in droves. But in terms of post-football career then, you know, just a little bit about what the Mad Dog did, has done since leaving the football pitch.
Well, so I've hinted at it earlier. I mean, he headed to Sin City, Las Vegas, and I guess, you know, I mean, I guess Ocean's 11 is the best example if you're looking for a sort of movie that Thomas was playing in, because he went out there and, you know, he earns up to about £100 million. And there's a variety of ways it could have been earned. There's lots of rumours, and in the book I go into them, because Thomas has no social media. He doesn't do any of that stuff. He doesn't give a shit about any of that kind of stuff. So he's very, how would I say, you know, he just lives his life. But he goes out there, he pops up in a gated community, living next to Nicolas Cage, Andre Agassi, and Pencil Lip, the magician. Of course, you know, only Thomas Graveson. I mean, you know, one of his teammates is actually walking through the pool at MGM Grand. I mentioned in the book, and he stops and hears Thomas sitting in a lounger, and he says, "Oh, how are you doing?" And they're talking, and he says, "So, Thomas, here, are you on holiday?" He says, "No, lad, I live here." And the guy says, stupid question, you know, where else were you going to end up? You know, Las Vegas. So he goes there. I mean, he almost becomes a hermit in a sense that, you know, he's out in the casinos, he's living life there, but they don't know him because obviously football's not massive there, and he's not a person that's going to be known in Vegas. So I think he can almost chill out and get back to being himself and get that smile back and that vibrancy back. You know, there's various things he does in Las Vegas. I mean, I think the best is that I talk about in the book how he's seen losing $54 million in a single game of poker. And everyone you talk to says, yeah, Thomas could do that. I could see him doing that, no problem. I could see him making it. Yeah. You know, losing that kind of money and just getting up and going home, you know, watching a bit of telly or whatever he does, you know, he wouldn't have... He probably could deal with that no problem, you know, because he was very like that. You know, I don't think anything really... I think it was about him as a person. I think all the material stuff and all the other stuff around him, that really doesn't affect him. But he's since built himself back up in Las Vegas, but he's since moved back to Vila. So he's back there. And I'm told by a few people in the town that know him, if you want to go and have a coffee, no problem. Just hang about and you'll see him walking about and just go up and grab him and say, "Hi, Thomas, I'm a fan of football," and he'll sit down and talk your ear off you. If you're wanting to talk to him about himself and get into the inner workings of his mind, he's very, very private and doesn't want to talk about that kind of stuff and sort of shuts it down. So you'll see very little of him in terms of a person. You know, he doesn't put a lot out there. I mean, it's, you know, it's unclear, is he single? From what I understand, he's single. He never got married in Vegas, but if you look online, there's lots of articles saying that he got married to this Czech American model, but they were just dating. They didn't get married, and so there's a lot of rumour. I mean, I think the best way to describe it, in Denmark, he's known as the unicorn, because he is this mythical guy where there's a lot of rumours swirling about and a lot of things happening that no one's quite sure everything that he's done. But I think Las Vegas was good for him, because I think he could come back to being the Thomas Graveson that he is. And I'm personally happy that happened, even although he had to give up football, the thing he loved. I think it's good that he got back his spring in his step as such, because I think the world of football maybe unintentionally had ground that out of him.
Final word with you, Gary. These characters are disappearing from the game, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. If ever a guy got a bad press, I think it's Thomas Graveson. The difference between the words artist and an artist are very small. You change three letters and you move one from one to the other. And certainly Chris's book emphasises how much that Graveson was as much an artist as an artist and in football. There's a famous or infamous video slotted when he was playing with Real Madrid, and there's the Galacticos, Beckham, I think Figo and Zidane are there, juggling the ball about and showing the skills off, heading it up in the air and juggling from foot to foot. And there's Graveson stretching his muscles. And this is the bad press that Graveson got because of that sort of perception that people had of him that was really disguised the ability they had. And, you know, Chris's book pulls that out, but it also pulls out the fact that the book's about the person, and football's just a backdrop. And I think all the great football books are like that. It focuses on the person himself rather than what he did, how many goals he scored and how many tackles he won, all that sort of thing. But you know, if you're interested in reading a book about a footballer from the perspective of the person rather than, you know, how many games he won, read Chris's book because it's a real interesting book.
You stole my summing up.
Sorry.
No, nothing wrong with that at all. You're
read that word for word. I mean, I sent him that email this morning and he just read that out word for word, so that's really nice of you.
I saw no email, sir.
Like I said, it is purely a human story about an incredibly interesting person who just happens to be a footballer, but yours was better, Gary. Yours was far better put than mine.
Thank you.
Well, like I say, as always, unfortunately, time's against us. Chris, it's been an absolute pleasure. And as always, I implore anyone with any interest in football, people who have a genuine interest in human characters, you know, your book Mad Dog Gravesen, you know, they definitely need to go out and just read an absolute fascinating story. Absolutely fascinating story.
That's great. No, thanks so much, guys, for your support. And, you know, it's lovely to talk to you guys as well. I mean, I think you guys do a great job as well. You're talking either about football, passionate, you're into it. You've not got any angles or any, you know, axe to grind or, you know, image to promote. You're just out there talking about football. And I think that's the beauty of the sport, that people can come together and have these chats. So it's been a pleasure to be here. And I really do appreciate all your kind words about the book. It's very nice.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, it's been great, Chris.
Yeah, fantastic, Chris.
So all that's left is obviously to thank tonight's guest. So, you know, like I say, Chris, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me. Thanks a lot.
Gary, once again, thank you for stealing my conclusion, but that's all right. Don't worry about it.
We've worked together too long, Stu, but it's an absolute joy. And thanks, Chris, for writing the book and B, for the interesting conversation this evening.
And Stephen, as always... always happy to talk about anything related to Denmark, so I'm sure this was no hardship for you tonight.
not an ounce of hardship there. Joy as always, Stu. And a big thanks to Chris again.
Okay, so all that's left is to say thank you to the listeners, and hopefully you'll join us again on the next edition of the Lob podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.